a dim bone, dim bone, dim drive.
Welcome to MRCS on the Move. Bowels, bones, and backseat drivers. I'm your host, Naomi, but this is the podcast where you do the talking. Good morning and welcome to another episode of Bowels, Bones and Backseat Vibers, MRCS on the Move. I hope you're having a good morning, good afternoon. I have just woken up, I've booked in an early session with our special guest this morning to record this episode, and I will make an apology again, sorry, morning voice, for my puppy Darcy. She's a little bit on the crazy side this morning and is running around chewing everything. So if you hear some funny noises in the background or some pattering, that will be why. We're also on Zoom today, so my first attempt at doing a recording over Zoom, which be interesting. We'll see how that goes. Hopefully, okay. I'm going to pause there because I can hear something being broken. So today we're going to be talking about more statistics. This is the third instalment of our mini statistics series. So I'd like to welcome back our special guest, Tim Dry. Dad,
hello.
Hi. How are you at the moment?
Pretty good.
Good. Are you looking forward to another episode?
Oh, of course. I always look forward to talking to someone about statistics.
And have you listened to the previous ones that you are not famous for?
No.
Okay, well they are out there in the big wide world, if you'd like
to. Don't flatter me by how many clicks they've had.
I think the first one's had about 57 listens.
Oh, right, that's more than my podcast usually get.
Well, there you go.
Very good.
There you go. I think there was about 50% retention, so if we take that as feedback, that perhaps we lose people halfway through.
Oh, retention is the people getting to the end, is it?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what that means, okay. I don't know what it means, but I'm not sure what we should do about it right now.
I'll try and be a bit more dynamic.
There we go. Yeah.
Interesting.
We can always try, can't we? You've had how many years? 50-odd years to practice?
Yes, yeah. I'm particularly pleased by 50% failure retention rate, so...
You're not particularly pleased?
No, I am particularly pleased. Oh. I'm not sure over the 50 years I've managed to get that usually.
I'd have to look back and tell you.
Most of the time.
I'd have to look back and tell you how that compares to my other special guest to let you know how you're doing.
Oh no, don't.
They've maybe got better topics in my opinion, but there you go.
Oh you
disagree.
Definitely can't have that. That can't be the reason.
Okay, right. Well, shall we crack on? So, we've not got too many things to discuss today, I think, because we're going to keep biased as a separate episode, I think we've decided. So we're going to go just through some definitions, which I'm sure you'll give us a nice long answer for anyway. As Dad has just warned me, we've got limited time to record this because he's got to go see the most important Arsenal game of the year, the North London Derby. So we cannot hold him up for that. So we are going to start with types of error. I think last time we ended talking about confidence intervals and standard error and things, so possibly feeds into all of this. Would that be correct, Dad?
Indeed, yeah. Oh, definitely. It's the underlying issue, yes.
Okay.
That helps set up that whole frame of reference, yeah.
Okay, so if I ask the listeners, what different types of error do people know and what can you tell me about them? What are they?
Okay, so I think we should be clear that actually this is when there's two possible outcomes and we're wanting to know whether or not we've chosen the right outcome based on the information that we've had. And once you're in that situation, you might be right at the same time as you're right and wrong at the same time as you're wrong, as when it's really wrong, because you've got a thing called the ground truth, which is what's actually the case. And so once you've got that, you've got a type one error, which is a false positive, which is when you say something is true compared to the ground truth, but when you compare it with the ground truth, it turns out to be that false, that the decision you should have made was false. Whereas a type two error false negative is when you say something isn't true, i.e. in one of the states, and it should have been the true state in the ground truth. And you have to be particularly careful when these arise, when you're using small samples, as it gives you a difficulty in learning out how to work things out. And the other thing you should bear in mind is that the assumption is quite often made that actually the two types of errors are equivalent to each other, and that's very often not the case, especially in a medical environment, where it might be more often than not an issue if you're a false negative, i.e. you tell someone they're healthy, for example, or not got the particular disease that you are looking at, when actually they have, because that may be the sense that you send someone away on a someone away rather than putting them further down the pathway to treatment, which would have been appropriate. You don't diagnose a thing that really is there.
Sorry, I was saving my shoe.
I'm trying to make that. So you made a true positive. You assumed from the noise under the table that something was being done, and it actually was being done.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
Whereas if the noise had happened and you'd moved and stopped and there was no shoe underneath and he'd say, then that would be a false positive.
Okay. I guess you can think of it like that.
If you ignored the noise and then found a chewed shoe underneath, that would be a false negative.
Well, there we go. There's a nice real life example for you all.
Played out in front of you, indeed.
Is it the case that type 2s are more susceptible to small sample sizes then? Would that, because it's not big enough to pick up the positive? Is that the true case?
It's all dependent on what the prevalence of the thing is that you're trying to measure. Now, typically, again, in a diagnostic environment, it's quite often the case that in most tests, the people with the illness are a small minority of the people who are presented to the test. And if that's the case, then the false negative is more likely to happen because it's got much smaller numbers inside the data. And so the small sample size error is larger compared to the process. We've had that recently as the prevalence of COVID has dropped. As it got down to very low levels, you were much more likely to be falsely negative when you took a COVID test and then took work off or whatever things happened because of that test, when it turned out that you were actually ill. It's something to be aware of when you've got very low prevalence.
Okay, so moving on, we'll talk about sensitivity and specificity. So we'll ask these individually, I think, if that's okay, Dad. So we'll start with, what is the definition of sensitivity? I want you to try and give me the definition. This is to the listeners, that you might give in an exam. So, you know, a short, sharp answer. Dad, you can try and give that somewhere in your answer, please.
Okay, so I'll make sure, I'll give this exam answer straight first. So it's the ability of a test to correctly identify people with a condition. So the false negative is low, and it can throw the net wide, and it's much higher, potentially false positive. Okay, so that's how many of those people who actually have the disease are actually captured by the test.
Okay. Oh, you don't have anything else to say about that?
I'm now trying to be succinct.
I think that's because you want to get to a football game, not because you want to do a short podcast episode.
Well, I guess this would be equivalent to whether how much is the case, the fact that you dreamt that we won actually predicts that we're going to win.
Well, I also dreamt that we beat Man City 16-0, so I don't really think my dreams are very reliable.
Well, it depends on, I mean, 16-0 is probably a bit extreme.
Yeah, I know. I said, you know, if it hadn't been so ridiculous, I'd be betting on my dreams, but yeah. Quite ridiculous. Unheard of, really.
Yes. Okay. And the way that you contest that is you can look back to some historic, and this is where we are outside the test. It's not a bad idea to just check your prior knowledge. So what do you anticipate to be the level of discrimination? And we can look back and see that 16-0 against Man City is an unlikely, very, very unlikely to happen. And therefore, the chances of us actually finding it are low and probably inconsequential. And it's probably a false positive.
Yes, probably.
So its sensitivity is quite low. Okay. So dreams are quite a low sensitivity.
Okay. How many tests has been? How many studies have been done on dreams? Actually, probably quite a lot.
Probably more than you imagine.
Yeah.
It has definitely been a topic of conversation, and that actually goes to the one of the problems that we've got in research at the moment is reproducibility. Mm. And that partly becomes from what we were discussing before about reviewing different previous tests and doing an overall review of the process. Because unfortunately, when people do tests of things like dreams and other telepathic skills and things like that, and forethought and all those sorts of elements, is that they'll do a test, and most tests will be inconclusive. They won't show any effects. They'll not reject the null hypothesis in those things, and they'll just disappear into the mists of time. But then once or twice, a test might show a positive result. It's run 20 times and happens more than once, so you get 2 times in 20 tests, and suddenly they publish it because they call that a significant test.
Oh, that's what you were talking about the other day, the last one. Where?
Yeah, that's right. So you end up having in the literature more positive evidence that an effect's taken place than would normally be the case.
Mm. Okay.
It's very unfortunate.
Mm. Okay. So we did manage to drive out.
That's one of the risks of meta-analysis.
Yes, as we mentioned in the first, first episode.
I was saying, but now I've got some wishful thinking floating in, because I want it to be the case that Man City lost 16-0.
Whoever it was to.
That Tottenham lose. And that is one of the risks that you should be very careful of how these things work. When you actually want the results, it's good.
Bias.
It's good scientific practice, and it becomes a source of confirmation bias and all those things, which we might talk about later. But it's an important principle when you're trying to set up a test, to try and test the thing that
Dad,
you don't want.
Hold on, sorry, dog causing mayhem.
True positive again.
Normally is when it comes to puppies. So, okay, so moving on, what is specificity?
So specificity, in contrast to sensitivity, is when you correctly identify those without the disease, so you have a low false positive. And this is actually much more important than you might imagine. I want you to think, and it's particularly the case, and one of the reasons why screening programs are quite, I almost advocate a dangerous thing. We often are told about screening programs and introduce them because we think we missed one or two in hindsight and were left late. But what we don't think about is if we do screen in order to catch the 1 in 1,000 who might have got missed, we may well capture another 99 say if the specificity is the case, who didn't have the disease. And those 99 can then take up a whole bunch of resources that wouldn't have been taken up if we hadn't done the screening process. And that the very take up of the resources means that the actual person who did have the disease gets lost anyway. And so when doing tests, it's quite often important to look at the, not the outcome of the test, but the long-term outcome of the patients overall in the cohort to find the overall impact of screening. And that's actually been proven to be the case with some forms of screening, particularly with prostate.
I was about to say, I'm fairly sure this is, this is the case with prostate cancer and PSAs.
Indeed.
In that the blood test will catch a lot more people and that will go on to then have possibly invasive, expensive, time-consuming and have an impact on them.
You get the case, that's right, sorry, Karen.
That have an impact on them mentally and stuff as well, you know, obviously.
Indeed. I one of my early projects I did in the health area, early on in my statistics career, was supporting some people looking at early onset of multiple sclerosis. And this is an example of how false positives can be dangerous. They were working with the slices of the brain of people who'd committed suicide on being told they got a diagnosis of MS. Mm. So it gave us the chance to look at the brain cells very, very early on in the disease, which did help some quite dramatic changes in what was the issues within MS. But clearly, I'm not sure we would have preferred people to commit suicide in order to then benefit from the outcomes. But that's one of the that's the extreme end of the mental health issue of a false positive, particularly with prostate cancer, where nowadays a lot of people can live with it. So they die with prostate cancer rather than die from prostate cancer.
Yep, indeed.
False positives are way more important than people think, particularly with issues which are very low prevalence.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to positive predictive value. So what does the audience think positive predictive value is?
Okay, so this is identifying as having the disease who actually do have it. And what you need to think about here is a small table with four cells in it, which are the true-true, the true-false, the false-true, and the false-false cells. And each of these words are different ratios of individual cell numbers with row or column numbers or the overall number of records in the data. And the reason I mention that is, and I think we've mentioned it already before, is there's been a lot of evidence now that when these numbers are presented as percentages, people misunderstand them and get the wrong impression, particularly of these two numbers, positive predictive value and specificity. And the advice nowadays is to try and use what are called natural frequencies. So rather than explaining things as percentages where you don't really know what the baseline is that the percentage is of, you give it as a number. So you might say that actually the predicted value is 2 in 100, for example. Or you might nowadays see the term, the number needed to treat, which says quite how many people should take this treatment before you save, in the largest extreme, how many need to take this treatment before you save one person's life?
So the lower the number needed to treat, the better?
Absolutely. The more impact this particular treatment has.
Yeah.
It's what's used by NICE, for example, as its way of advocating a treatment, because it's a bit like a cost-benefit analysis. But it's also a number which helps people be a bit more natural. Yeah. People, whereas if a pharmaceutical company is trying to sell their treatment, they will almost certainly present it as a percentage, because they can present a percentage where, say you're moving from 2 in 100 to, so if your number needed to treat changes by 50%, it could be that that's only from 2 in 1,000 to 3 in 1,000.
Mm.
So it sounds like a very big improvement, yeah. And relatively it is, but it's not got a very big impact.
Yeah. So then negative predictive value is...
Well, that's the... That...
Oh, you're learning. I didn't ask the question properly, to be fair. So, audience, what is negative predictive value?
The negative predictive value is the opposite to positive, and it's the ability to identify those who do not actually have a disease.
So, well, I've just done a project on MRIs in prostate cancer. So, mm-hmm. It's the example of negative predictive value of the MRI is its ability to identify prostates that don't have prostate cancer in, if that makes sense.
Yeah, knock them out of the pathway, if you like.
Yeah. So, as a PIRES 2 or less, like, what's the... Mm. And then you compare that to the when people go on to have biopsies. So, are they correctly identifying the PIRES 2 and below when compared to the eventual biopsy result? Of which they actually have quite...
When you're reviewing results and things, that word, the positive and negative are... often forgotten when they talk about the predictive value. So they'll talk about predictive value when they're assessing some sort of test, and you've got to quickly work out which one of those it is, because it'll quite often get left out.
Mm. Yeah, okay, fine. I don't
the default is usually the positive predictive value. That's what people usually, if they drop the word, that's usually what they mean.
Mm. Okay. Okay, fine. The only other thing I was going to mention was number needed to treat, but we've touched on that already, haven't we?
But I'm glad you were thinking that, because they say that natural frequencies element is much more important than people think.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll stop there for, as we've mentioned, a few different reasons, and we will come back and do a last episode. Potentially, we could carry on if we think of more things to talk about.
Well, I'm sure I can think of more things to talk
about. and we'll do an episode on biased and confounding factors and that sort of thing, I guess, come into that.
There is a book that I came across which talks about reasons for errors, and there's 14 different reasons for errors in that book.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. okay. Well, I hope everyone has a great day. We will speak to you again soon. And I hope everyone wants Arsenal to win.
As I say, if Tottenham loses, I'll still be smiling.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye. Oh, well, a dim bone, dim bone, dim. Try bone.